Southwest Airlines says it has found cracks in two more of its 737s. That brings the total number of damaged planes to six, and it includes the plane that had its fuselage rupture at 36,000 feet last Friday. Southwest has finished inspecting all 79 of its planes that could be susceptible to such damage. NPR's Wade Goodwin is following the story, and he's now on the line with us from Dallas. Wade, let's start with the details of these cracks. What are they, and what exactly is the problem?
Well, imagine two seams that run the full length of the plane down the top. In a jet, these seams are called lap joints. Now, as you travel down the lap joint, every few inches, there is something called a tear strap. It's a fastener across the lap joint that reinforces it. The tear straps are there so that if there is a rupture along the lap joint, theoretically it should only go as far as the tear strap. And the tear straps do more than just contain the ruptures. The straps also help keep cracks in the skin from forming in the first place. Now, in these older model 737s, Boeing engineers put a tear strap along the lap joint every 20 inches. But eventually, the engineers decided that every 20 inches wasn't going to get it, so Boeing began putting tear straps every 10 inches. So it's these older 737s that are cracking.
And Southwest flies those older 737s that are made that way. Alaska Airlines has two. Is this an airline issue or is it a manufacturing issue, a Boeing issue? What has Boeing, for instance, had to say about this?
They're surprised. They're surprised this problem is happening so quickly. Their engineers say they didn't expect to have to even inspect these lap joints until a plane had flown 60,000 flight cycles. But the plane that ruptured on Friday, Southwest plane, hadn't even made it to 40,000 flight cycles. A flight cycle is just one flight, a takeoff and a landing. And then for Southwest to find five more planes with cracks out of the 79 that they're flying, that's not great.
And the FAA, what does it suggest should be done about this?
Well, they want all the planes inspected, which Southwest already did over the weekend. And from now on, this model is going to have to be inspected with electromagnetic tests every 500 flights. And the way Southwest flies, that'll be every 10 weeks. This is a time-consuming check. You've got to run eddy current through the skin. And remember, before this accident on Friday, this test wasn't even required, period. So this is a new and unhappy understanding that's been developed over the weekend.
These six Southwest jets with cracks in them, they all, as I understand, have been taken out of service. Will they return to the skies?
That's a good question. My guess is that Boeing will shamefacedly come up with a fix. The FAA will bless it, and Southwest will repair these jets. But given the hassle that this model has become, if I was a betting man, I would bet its days in Southwest fleet are numbered. I mean, they love their 737s, but I think Boeing would agree the 737 has been a good airplane. This shouldn't be happening no matter what the model.
That's NPR's Wade Goodwin in Dallas. Wade, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
All Things Considered continues right after this.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll get the final word on men's college basketball. The championship game was last night. It was one of the lowest scoring, and some critics are saying the least fun college basketball championship game ever. But first to the trash talk, the insults, the low verbal blows of April Madness. Of course, we're talking about taxes. The country's largest tax preparation firm, H&R Block, is talking down its rivals.
Worried about your taxes? At H&R Block, we found errors on 4 out of 5 returns prepared by others.
This year, the insinuation in that commercial was enough for Jackson Hewitt, the second largest tax preparation firm in the U.S., to file a lawsuit against H&R Block. Now, however that goes, it does raise the question of just how you can figure out if your tax preparer knows what he or she is doing, particularly because if the preparer makes a mistake, the taxpayer is still on the hook. So to figure this out, we've called one of our money coaches, Luis Barajas, and he is still what is called an enrolled agent licensed to practice before the IRS. So, Luis, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Now, the Inspector General at the Treasury Department found up to a 61% error rate on tax returns prepared by authorized but unlicensed tax preparers. So as an enrolled agent who's no doubt spent some time thinking about this, is that surprising? Are people's taxes really, most people's taxes, really that complicated that the error rate should be that high?
No, they're not really that complicated, and that doesn't surprise me. But at the same time, they don't take into effect that most people wait until the very last minute, and when you go see a tax preparer, they're pretty much doing, 75% of all the tax preparations are going to be done in the last couple of weeks of it before April 15th. And so there are a lot of mistakes that are being made just because tax returns are being done in a hurry.
So now if you what kind of person should probably go out and try to find a paid tax preparer? Since there's so many other resources out there, there's, software and so forth that people can use. Is there a certain kind of profile of taxpayer who you think really needs to think about getting some help? Or is it just if you're scared to do it yourself?
Well, first of all, the thing is this, is that a long time ago, most people who were what I call, basically poor, who didn't have a lot of money, who only worked one job, could actually go out and do it themselves, and it was really pretty basic. But now, there are a lot of credits that, people who don't earn a lot of income can get and who don't get them. For example, the earned income credit. And so it requires a little bit more savvy when it comes to tax preparation as it did in the past, because the tax laws are really complicated. So my suggestion is that at one time, you'd like to go see somebody who's a professional who can help you, who can identify certain tax credits that you may be able to get. And then if the return after it's done is not that complicated, you can do it in the following years. But the average person who has a small business, the person who owns a home, who has children, who runs a business, these are the people that need to hire somebody professionally because they can find them a lot more deductions than the average consumer can do on their own.
So let's talk about how you find that person. First of all, is there any entity that supervises tax preparers? Is there some sort of basic credential that you should be looking for?
Well, you should look for somebody who is a specialist in tax law or tax preparation. And just have to be careful because most of the three people that you're really going to do your tax returns could be certified public accountants or CPAs, enrolled agents who are licensed by the IRS, and then you have in certain states they license tax repairs, like here in California, they'll license the tax repair. Now, the problem is that you have to be really savvy about when you're hiring a CPA. Now, I worked for a big CPA firm years ago, a firm called Ernst & Young, and so what happened is that a lot of CPAs are really focused on audits, and there's some that just focus on tax. So not all CPAs are really good tax preparers, so you have to be careful about that. Make sure that they're specialists in tax. Enrolled agents are actually specialists who should be the best people out there preparing tax returns because they have a lot of continuing education requirements when it comes to tax law. They can also represent you in case you get audited anywhere in the country. And then a tax preparer. It doesn't mean that a tax preparer isn't, as good as an enrolled agent or a CPA. The only thing is you want to make sure that they have years of experience and they have a reputation for doing things right, not for getting the best or the biggest refunds.
How would you know?
Well, it's easy because what happens is you have to be careful about locations where you go where they're offering you really inexpensive tax preparation services. Be careful about the places where you go and they'll do it inside a furniture store or a check cashing store or a auto dealer and they use your refund to go purchase a car or purchase more furniture. That should be a red flag. Avoid the tax preparation places where they'll do check cashing and they marry you and they divorce you and they remit money to other parts of different countries and they do taxes. You have to look for someone who is a specialist and who does this as a full-time job year-round. That should be the first clue. The second thing
The first clue is don't – one of these places that's kind of set up in a tent in the parking lot, selling fruit on the side, that's not what you want. You want somebody who's there if you have a problem later on.
Absolutely. Right. And also, you have to be very careful. Again, it's on what the fees that they're charging you. If they're promising you a very inexpensive return because you're going to do a rapid anticipation loan or they're going to, upfront you the refund and charge you a really high interest rate on that money, you've got to be very careful about those places. So find somebody who's been doing it for a long time, who's got who's been at one place for a long time, because these fly-by-night tax preparation places also – should alert you that if they haven't been around in the same location for at least a couple, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, I don't know if I'd go there.
Now, what about this whole question of a guaranteed refund? There are those who say that just if somebody's guaranteeing you a refund, that should be in itself a red flag. Why is that?
Absolutely, because refunds have nothing to do with your amount of tax liability every year. You just did the proper, improper withholdings, meaning that if you're getting money at the end of the year, you might have just filled out your W-4 wrong when you filled it out, when they withhold your taxes every year. And so that has nothing to do with how good the tax preparer is. So guaranteeing a refund is a huge red flag.
And maybe it goes without saying, but you are supposed to be honest with your tax preparer, right? It's not like you're not supposed to come in with us children you don't actually have. And, maybe we shouldn't need to say that, but.
Well, no, you know what? We do need to say that. First of all, you need to be extremely honest with your tax preparer, but you also have to be careful about tax preparers who are kind of goading you on to take deductions that you may not be worthy of. I mean, so for example, I have seen many tax returns where a tax preparer had made a husband and a wife, they had two kids, file HIDA household returns, which they cannot do if they're married, and so they can get a bigger tax deduction. And so you have to be very careful also on the other side when a tax preparer is telling you, hey, we can do this or we can do that, and I know something more than the other tax preparers, another big red flag.
And finally, if you are worried that your tax preparer has made a mistake, you did what you just said, is you did your taxes in a rush at the end, right toward the filing deadline. You're worried. What can you do? What's your recourse after the fact? Is there
not
any
problem whatsoever? I mean, if you do actually find, and remember, when you complete a tax return, you sign the tax return saying that you know that all the information there is correct, and your tax preparer pretty much doesn't really have any liability when it comes to that. I mean, it's very little. You can go back and amend your tax return. You can file what's called a 1040X. And go back and amend the return and do it right and then pay back the taxes that you might owe. And it's not a big problem. I mean, once you get it done, it's easily taken care of.
And finally, I did want to ask you, what is it, if that dreaded word comes, audit, and you find that you are being audited, presumably you've represented taxpayers before audits. Is it as terrifying as it seems? What should you do to be prepared?
Yeah, if you've actually tried to do the best job that you can on your tax return and you do get audited, the very first thing you have to do is not avoid the paperwork that's coming in the mail or that envelope and just think the problem's going to go away. You need to address it very quickly. Most of the time, it's just a misunderstanding. I would say 75% of the time, it's just a misunderstanding, and you can go in and any IRS office and take care of it. Within an hour, it's all resolved. If you have bigger issues, you can hire, for example, a CPA or enrolled agent to go there and represent you. Now, if you've been doing some bad things and really not doing your taxes as you should, then you have something to worry about because they can go back several years and audit you for the other years as well.
But none of our listeners would do that.
Well, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Luis Barajas talks matters of personal finance with us on a regular basis. His new book is called My Street Money, A Street Level View of Managing Money from the Heart to the Bank. And as we mentioned, he is an enrolled agent with the IRS. And so he does, as we said, prepare taxes and represent taxpayers before the IRS. And he was kind enough to join us on the line from his home office in Irvine, California. Luis, thanks so much.
Oh, as always, thank you so much.
Okay, World Wrestling Entertainment is no longer just about large men in small shorts walloping each other in front of jeering crowds. The company behind the shows SmackDown and Raw has started an independent film studio. It makes action movies, comedies, and even small serious films, starring the likes of Danny Glover, Ned Harris. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Ted DiBiase Jr. is old school wrestling royalty.
How much can DiBiase take?
His dad was a wrestler. His granddad was a wrestler. So was his grandmother. But now, Ted DiBiase Jr. is really into acting.
You actually get more takes. You know, if you mess up on something, it's like, can I do that again? I don't ever get that option with Monday Night Raw. This is great.
DiBiase is built, blue-eyed, and seems as wholesome as a bowl of Wheaties. So it's no surprise the WWE had him anchor an action flick.
Who are you? What do you think you're doing here?
They're separatists.
The Marine 2 went straight to DVD when it came out 2 years ago. Reviews were unkind. That's been generally true of most WWE movies so far. Wrestling blogger Kevin Eck saw The Marine for one 6'2", 250-pound reason. Its star, wrestler John Cena.
It amazes me that a guy like John Cena has so much charisma
oozing out of him when he plays his wrestling character. But I think in the movies that he's done so far, he comes across kind of wooden.
Intel confirmed. 9 hostiles, 3 Marines.
Ghost 2, you are not to engage. Alpha Team is on its way.
No time.
You'd think going from pro wrestling to acting would be intuitive. It's all performance art, right? But Kevin Eck, who's also a sports editor for the Baltimore Sun, says wrestlers' spectacular showmanship is ill-served by the small, tightly controlled space of movie sets.
You don't get to ad-lib, and you don't get to interact with an audience. You don't have that rush of being in front of 15,000 people, millions watching you live on TV.
From behind, Sheamus!
WWE is a formidable global entertainment company. Revenues last year topped $470 million. Only about 4% of that came from the film studio. But it's still one of the company's fastest-growing divisions. Kevin Eck's theory as to why involves the WWE's notorious chairman.
If you know Vince McMahon or know his reputation at all, he's clearly a control freak. And I think what he doesn't want to happen is for anyone to get as big as The Rock. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is no longer property of WWE, so I think they learned from that.
The Rock's small part in 2001's The Mummy Returns led to a new career when the movie made over $400 million.
Haku Machete!
Now he's left the ring for the screen and co-starring with such lofty thespians as Anthony Hopkins and Michael Caine. And he'd prefer that you call him Dwayne Johnson. WWE studio head Mike Pavone used to write and create TV shows. He says, compared to certain actors, pro wrestlers bring a reliable work ethic to movies.
They show up on time, they know their lines, they hit their marks, they're performers, they get it. I'll take these guys any day.
The hope is that their movies will bring a new audience to the WWE and expand the company's brand.
You get so much credibility from a Patricia Clarkson or an Ed Harris.
That's 4 Oscar nominations, Ed Harris. He has the lead in an upcoming WWE film, a period film set in the 1960s. He plays a high school teacher accused of being gay.
I guess I just don't know how my private life has any bearing on my ability as a teacher.
It's like the WWE's The Children's Hour. But why would an Ed Harris or a Patricia Clarkson do a World Wrestling Entertainment film?
It's about money, and it's about availability.
Mike Pavone says WWE's fast shoots are easily squeezed into stars' busy schedules. His friendship with an A-list casting director helps, too. As for WWE wrestler Ted DiBiase Jr., in the ring, he's a heel, a bad guy. What would he like his next movie to be?
I'll be honest with you. I'm a sucker for chick flicks.
Cage matches, choke slams, chick flicks. To make it in show business, it's not bad to have a little something for everyone. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Men's March Madness fizzled last night, 53-41. It sounds like a halftime score, but that was the final score in the championship game as the UConn Huskies beat the Butler Bulldogs, the fewest total points in a title game since 1949. We've asked Ken Pomeroy to help us chew through the numbers. He tracks all sorts of college basketball statistics on his website, kenpom.com. And Ken, we talked to you last week on the program. Welcome back.
Thanks, Melissa. I'm glad to be back.
Well, let's start with Butler's abysmal shooting, just 3-for-31 on two-point shots, a new low for an NCAA tournament game. What else do your numbers show? Purely a dreadful offense, or does this reflect really great defense on UConn's part?
Well, UConn did play very good defense. There's no taking that away from them. It was a combination of very good UConn defense and Butler just having an off night, to say the least. That 2-point percentage of 10% was the worst 2-point percentage of any Division I game this season. So it's not just a tournament record, not just a Final Four record. I mean, this was a historically bad game in exactly the wrong time to have it.
Anything in your statistics that Butler's low score doesn't reveal?
Well, they actually had some quality offensive rebounding. They were able to take care of the ball very well. They did some good things offensively. If you'd told me going in that they were going to offensive rebound 35% of their shots and they were only going to turn the ball over on about 1 out of every 10 possessions, I would have said they're going to score some points. But in the end, it's still about putting the ball in the basket, and Butler could only put the ball in the basket 12 times last night.
And Connecticut came out on top, but it wasn't pretty getting there.
No, for sure. And Butler's bad offensive night really masked the fact that they played some pretty good defense themselves. UConn shot 19 for 55, which ordinarily would probably lose you about 80% of your games. But because of Butler's poor showing, UConn was able to pull it out, even with only 55 points. And part of the reason was they, too, got good offensive rebounding. So they were able to get some more cracks at the basket, and they just were able to convert a little bit more often than Butler was.
You know, I wonder, looking back at the numbers that you've been tracking throughout the season, were there any tip-offs of what this matchup would look like? Or was this just completely off the charts?
It wasn't completely off the charts. I mean, you can never predict something as awful as what we saw, but neither team was a good shooting team during the season. And in particular, UConn had played some pretty good defense of late. They held Kentucky to 12 for 35 on their two-point shooting in the previous game in the Final Four, which is pretty bad. Not as bad as Butler would end up shooting, but it's still pretty bad. So in that sense, you know, you could see some signs that Butler was not going to shoot very well, but you know, there was no way to predict what ended up unfolding.
You know, one of the things you track on your site, Ken, is luck, right? Do you also track just bad luck?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, that enters into every game. And if you watch the game last night, as I said, UConn played good defense, but Butler had some pretty easy shots in the second half that they ended up getting, and it was like by that point they were so flustered. You know, they were blowing layups, they were blowing shots where they, you know, had a clear path to the basket, and that contributed to their low point total for sure.
Okay. Ken Pomeroy crunches NCAA basketball numbers for his website, kenpom.com. Ken, enjoy the offseason.
All right. Thanks a lot.